Today on Against the Grain, people of color, whether welfare recipients or immigrants, are routinely characterized in the United States as shiftless, even parasitic, and not deserving of the social supports of the state. My guest argues that in recent years, as the social safety net has been chopped away, the right has branded white working class people with the same racially charged language of being parasites on the state. Ethnic studies scholar Daniel Martinez Hosang joins me to talk about the complexities of how racial categories are reworked, as well as the appeal of the far right for some people of color and the presence of people of color in the leadership of some far right groups. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Lazy parasites versus virtuous producers. For a century and a half, these categories have been used to mark off those who are seen to be self-sufficient, autonomous, and worthy of social protection, usually white people, and those who are viewed as indolent and undeserving, usually people of color. But Daniel Martinez Hosang argues that racism is being constantly remade, and in our times of austerity, it's not simply black and white. He's associate professor of ethnicity, race, and migration, and of American studies at Yale University. With his co-author, Joseph Lowndes, he's written Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. Dan, before we get to the arguments that you make in your book, I need to begin by asking you about the storming of the Capitol on January 6th by far-right supporters of Donald Trump. In the subsequent weeks, there have been many takes on what happened from progressives and from the left, ranging from panic about incipient fascism, on the one hand, and on the other, the argument that this was, in fact, a moment of defeat for the far right, and that we should not allow it to obscure the consolidation of the neoliberal order under Biden. How do you understand a moment like this?
Well, thanks for that really important question. And I think there's a way in which all the dynamics you just touched on matter and are relevant to how we might think about this moment. My co-author, Joe Lowndes, and I recently argued in a piece that there's a temptation to think about what happened, and especially the response, the withdrawal of a whole set of GOP support, many others across the political spectrum, a kind of end of the apologies for this long record of Trumpism, as a kind of final defeat, the end of some kind of chapter. But I think based on our research and thinking, we've seen many, many times in the past where you've had these moments where these kind of violent clashes and confrontations might suggest a kind of winnowing or narrowing of support for the far right. And the opposite often happens. It kind of anticipates a certain mode of dissent, a way, a kind of rebellion that both enlarges and energizes their ranks and numbers, but also has some surprising effects on others in the kind of center-right part of the political spectrum. So we think it's not a moment to underestimate in terms of their future ambitions and capacities.
Well, we're going to be talking in a lot of depth about the right itself and the ways that race plays so centrally into that. But I wanted to start, because this is key to the argument that you and your co-author make, with your assessment on the context in which all of this has appeared over the last four decades. The changes to, if you will, the political economy of the United States and how it's affected working class and middle class people, both white and of color.
Yeah. I mean, this is central, the kind of evisceration, especially of kind of public resources and commitments towards workers, towards a social wage, is for us the absolute kind of material backdrop and context to understanding the growing influence of some of these groups on the far right. Part of the argument we make is that certainly in the latter part of the 20th century, the growth of the New Deal and other social insurance programs, to be regarded as white and racialized as white was to assume that you had some access to that social wage, some as access to those protections in the form of labor unions, other social insurance programs, etc. The winnowing out of those public commitments that really started in the late 1960s with attacks on welfare, attacks on women of color, that then led into attacks on immigrants on through discourses of dependency. Really, these racialized attacks really undermined access that many people of color in the U.S. had to those programs. With those ta attacks largely complete by the 90s, we note increasingly the ways that white workers themselves became the object of the same kinds of accusations about dependency and parasitism and the lack of kind of a cultural ethic of work to justify their own abandonment. So, in many ways, we're arguing that the very explicitly racist attacks that helped to narrow eligibility for lots of social programs were ultimately brought to bear on many white people themselves by the early 2000s.
And you argue that while racism is an enduring feature of American life, as you're sort of pointing to, the forms of it have changed over time. And I wonder how you would characterize it today. How would you see how racism operates and basically facilitates a process in which inequalities can endure and be perpetuated?
Yeah, this is really the way racism provides a language and a legitimation for people's abandonment, for their marginalization and their dispossession. And again, all from the 1960s on, with attacks on many programs, the assumption was that it was people of color themselves who bore the responsibility that they had not lived up to the expectations, the kind of work values, the ethics that would make them eligible for civic recognition and a decent life. But when those protections are denied so broadly, they just no longer restricted themselves to women of color, people of color alone. And so that's part of the argument that they're capturing a growing segment of the US population. It's certainly not the case that white workers who lose their jobs, find themselves unable to access other social benefits, are in the equivalent position of black or brown workers and communities. That's not the case at all. Those distinctions are critical. But the same political forces and explanations that have been used to dispossess so many people of color are now being brought to bear on white Americans themselves. And we think that creates many of the conditions that lead to this kind of insurgent militia patriot kind of movement.
Tell us about the notion of people as parasites, how that category has been applied, and how racially charged it is, and how it contrasts with the idea of the producer.
So this is an idea that goes back to, 150 years and the kind of origins of capitalism that offers kind of cultural or you might say character-driven explanations for why some people succeed and others fail. So even Marx has a passage about this, about there's, some people that are they're destined to save, to work hard, to not succumb to immediate pleasures and gratification. And that has congealed in the US around this figure of the producer, often racialized as white, gendered as a male, who is autonomous, who is dependent only on themselves alone, and who demonstrates the virtues that drive market economies. And the contrast to that is the figure of the parasite, the person that refuses work, that doesn't have self-control or self-regulation, and that wants to feed off of the labor of others. Now, the figure of the parasite themselves has actually changed across history. So in the early 20th century, many European immigrant workers, especially from Eastern and Southern Europe, are regarded as parasitic on a kind of more white Anglo-Saxon proletariat citizenry. In the mid 20th century, that figure of the parasite kind of gets absorbed into a more generic American whiteness, and it becomes Black people, Latinos, in different cases, indigenous people, Asian Americans, that stand in for that dependent parasitic figure. And that's always been central to the logic of the inequality that market economies and capitalism itself produces. And again, our argument is by the early kind of 21st century, when you see more attacks on white workers in public sector unions, in rural areas that are increasingly abandoned by industry and the state, there's a question about how their dispossession, how their death in some cases is going to be narrated. And it's not surprising that it's through a turn to this language of dependence, failure, parasitism that dominant institutions and elites make use of to help legitimate it and protect the kind of basic structures of the economy and the state from broader criticism.
Tell us more about that. So, and particularly as it unfolded after the Great Recession of 2008, where, of course, there were major attacks on public sector workers and the state trying to sort of pass over to public sector workers the responsibility for the global financial crisis. And you write how right-wing pundits like Rush Limbaugh started branding public unionized, of course, public sector workers as parasites and freeloaders, in effect taking these highly racially charged terms that had been used against undocumented immigrants and poor African-American women, you know, characterized as welfare queens, leeching off the entitlements of the state. Tell us about that moment and how that took shape.
Yeah, I mean, we have to remember, when the financial crisis first exploded in 2007 and 2008, Wall Street and the banks were understood very much publicly as the culprits, the authors of all of this devastation. And you know, soon after that, within the next year, and this really we can also trace this to the emergence of the Tea Party, when there was federal intervention to really bail out the banks, but that was reframed as kind of safeguarding or not holding accountable the quote unquote losers. These were the people who had allegedly taken out bad loans through their own misjudgment and misguidance, and that they should be held culpable for their actions. Now, this is on the one hand very much a racialized and gendered script about kind of who lacks that capacity to make appropriate political, economic, and social decisions. But what's striking here is that that charge is no longer limited to immigrants, to in Black communities and Black women. It's now generalizable to many, many people who were affected by the recession. And within a couple of years, in 2010 and 2011, across the political spectrum, from Democrats and Republicans alike, you had an emerging discourse that said, well, the reason that municipalities and states are broke is because of these unsustainable contracts and financial commitments given to public sector unions, to teachers, to custodial workers, to toll booth collectors, et cetera. So all of a sudden, this kind of narrative gets mobilized publicly that says they're actually the culprits for this global financial recession. And it was surprising to us as we were running out of time how quickly that congealed as a common sense explanation and actually kind of in many ways turned people against one another. This led to the whole mobilization in Wisconsin and Ohio of public sector workers defending their benefits. I think we can see its legacies down the line and the way the teachers organized later in the 2010s to resist attacks on them. But I just want to point out how quickly that process happened from kind of holding the banks accountable for this catastrophe to cultural explanations that turned it into the homeowner that took out a bad mortgage, or the teacher that greedily expected a retirement. And that was only possible because these longstanding narratives and scripts, which had so long been used on people of color, were available to make these charges.
Indeed. I'm speaking with Daniel Martinez Hosang. He's associate professor of ethnicity, race, and migration and of American studies at Yale University. He is the co-author of Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race, and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you, in your book, you also trace, as a part of this look at the shifting sands of race and how racial categories are reworked in the interests of perpetuating inequalities, you write about the rise of Black politicians within the Republican Party, including, and you mentioned a moment ago, the Tea Party. I wonder if you could talk about that. Obviously, the Republican Party has been an extremely white organization. How have Black politicians emerged, and in some sense, why?
It's challenging because it requires us to kind of keep in our minds a number of contradictory dynamics, which is it's absolutely right that the base of the Republican Party is white, that it's built its kind of modern form around racial exclusions and racial domination, and that that is central to the party's identity. At the same time, we can understand really across US society in the last 30 to 40 years, the way discourses about multiculturalism and diversity have served as a kind of ethical and legitimating dynamic for many institutions. So just think about corporate America, all the ways they've embraced a certain kind of language of racial diversity and difference to make connections to consumers, to fashion their brand, et cetera. So this is the kind of contradictory thought we have to hold together, which is the formations can be both steeped in domination and they can be inclusive to some degree and extend their kind of parameters and base beyond their core white constituency. And this doesn't just mean we're not really talking about significant sectors of Black voters or Latino voters, although there's changing dynamics there as well. But we're talking about the ways that the Republican Party, in particular, in conservatism, in search of narratives about the kind of ways that markets are the best solution to lift people up, kind of attacks on the welfare state and social programs, defenses of militarism and nationalism, that a figure in 2012 like Mitt Romney is sometimes not the best person to make those kind of claims or for people to identify with, someone associated with investment banking, intergenerational wealth, et cetera. By contrast, you have a figure like Senator Tim Scott in South Carolina, African-American senator, who is wildly popular with the Tea Party, white Tea Party supporters, in large part because he does seem to exemplify those very commitments in much more sincere ways. So for many conservatives, Tim Scott is a far more genuine, accessible figure than certainly someone like Mitt Romney or even someone like Lindsey Graham. And we see this in kind of fits and starts across the Republican Party, where people of color seem to kind of most closely embody and express deeply conservative values.
Well, if this is visible within the Republican Party, it's even more discordantly visible in the even further right. And there are, you know, as we have seen, these far-right militias and different organizations like the Proud Boys or Patriot Prayer, there's the discordant dimension that these organizations that certainly look from the outside like white supremacist organizations often will have people of color, that is, men of color specifically, in leadership roles. Why is that the case, and how does this play out without just exploding?
So we started attending Patriot and militia, observing some of their rallies and events in the mid 2010s, early 2010s. And when you first went to them, it's I think what many people might expect. It's like a broad range of issues. They're not really tied down to particular issues. Sometimes they talk about abortion. Sometimes they talk about the federal government. Sometimes they talk about other religious issues. But it was a kind of just these somber mixtures that felt very small and not terribly energetic. There were a series in the Pacific Northwest of growing confrontations with the federal government. There was a takeover of a federal wildlife refuge in late 2015 that were increasingly animated around this criticism of an overreaching state that had failed and abandoned a populace, had left people on their own, that had conspired with big business and tech. And that message of abandonment and failure and a criticism of the state actually had a growing resonance. It emerged in a context of a kind of anti-Obama politics, but as Trump ran and started to really inhabit that as this kind of dissident anger against elites, it proved that I think that message, and then kind of trying to inhabit a position in a movement that was not going to take it anymore and was willing to rebel and strike back, actually proved much more attractive to a broader range of people. And so we're very clear that at the heart of these patriot and militia groups very much are longstanding currents of patriarchy, white supremacy, nativism. That's unmistakable. But they've accompanied that appeal actually proves broader than you might imagine. And especially when it's not framed in explicitly racist terms, which for these groups it rarely is. And so I think that's part of what explains the kind of surprising diversity, we might say, of these groups while still taking seriously what their social and political vision is.
Tell us about Joey Gibson, who you start the book with. He's the founder of the far-right group Patriot Prayer, and the contradictions that someone like him illustrates.
So we interviewed Gibson for this book. Patriot Prayer is a group that really came to the scene in kind of 2016, 17, and as a kind of form of like street Trumpism after Trump's election. And when we sat down with him, we tried to tease out where his political influences are, how he thinks about the world. Gibson is himself Japanese American, absolutely identifies as a person of color, as do several other people in the leadership of Patriot Prayer. And he talked actually about the civil rights movement. He talked about their willingness to criticize the state, to endure violence from the state, to endure violence from counter protesters as well because of their commitment to their moral principles. And this has nothing to do with whether that's genuine or not. There's certainly Patriot Prayer itself has no connection to the bearing of the kind of moral and political vision of the civil rights movement. But it does show how they're kind of open and dynamic in certain ways to claiming different kinds of political traditions. And we didn't take it as a kind of just a facade that they were putting forward to disavow or to respond to criticisms that they are racist. In fact, they really do see themselves as kind of inheriting a populist, multiracial legacy of a people who are tired of the state's inaction or violence against them and are organizing themselves to reclaim their lives, their government, and their world. So it played a really animating role in their sense of what their group stood for. And I think in certain ways that they attracted other kinds of supporters. And it's surprising if you look at the website of a group like the Three Percenters and many others, you will all cross all of these groups. Certainly true for the Proud Boys, references to their that it's a kind of multiracial assemblage that can stand for these principles.
Well, and this speaks partially anyway to a larger question, which is what is the appeal of Trump, who also traffics in all sorts of highly racialized, let's just say racist discourse, for a substantial number of people of color, something that I think we on the left can't easily just wave away. As we saw with the recent election, his support by some populations of Latinos and Asian Americans grew. What do you think is Trump's appeal to obviously very diverse populations?
I mean, I think first we want to be clear that the argument is certainly not that these groups, you know, some blocks of Latino voters, Asian American voters, et cetera, even the people that are at the leadership of these groups somehow explain or are at the, you know, are culpable in a larger sense in the rise of Trump. That's not the case. Numerically, we're still talking about a smaller number of people. But I do think it is an important reminder of, in certain ways, the ways that people's sense of like dissent and frustration can so easily be channeled into racist, nativist, and misogynistic impulses. And I think it speaks to actually how pervasive they are across many, many different political formations, communities, et cetera. So it obviously very much, it not just debunks the notion of a kind of colorblind polity or citizenry, actually talks about how important ideas about racism, about humiliation, about segregation, violence continue to be in the way that many, many people think about their lives and their world. So I say that to say that it's certainly not that they were drawn to Trump in spite of those gestures, but that there's a long tradition of expressing those sentiments as a way to announce one's strength and dissent and purpose. And I think that's very much what we witnessed, that we've long witnessed with Trumpism in the last 5 years. And it's not surprising that that message finds fertile ground in a broad range of people who are politically socialized and conditioned in this country's history.
And it's obviously very relevant in that there has been an assumption amongst certainly kind of the liberal mainstream and I would say progressives, people on the left as well, that as the U.S. becomes more ethnically diverse, it will become less conservative. Do you think that is somewhat misguided, or that we're not taking the appeal of conservative ideas, however repugnant we may find them, seriously enough?
Yeah, so I think that's exactly right. Some assumption, you know, that's often expressed as demography as destiny is clearly not right. That there's a broad diversity, as in every place and kind of community sets diversity of ideas, experiences, worldviews, and that those are, as they are for all of us, framed through political action. So, you know, we see in places like Arizona, certainly many places like Georgia, you know, Nevada, California in the 90s, years of deliberate, purposeful action that builds people's consciousness, their commitments, et cetera, that helps to explain their political orientation and disposition. In other places, South Florida, certainly in the last election, the South Texas as well, times where other ideas are available and people are drawn to them. The other thing I want to say is that, look, you know, even California in the last 5 years, 4 to 5 years, has been, on the one hand, the site of really important resistance to Trumpism. On the other hand, we know the housing crisis, the wealth inequality, levels of incarceration, houselessness. Californians, liberal Californians, have long abided, tolerated, and legitimated, given their consent, to profound forms of inequality, including racial inequality, segregation, et cetera. So I think this is a caution against us just imagining that but for Trumpism or the right or these groups, we would be inhabiting some structure and polity that's multiracial, that's egalitarian, et cetera. In other words, this is structured in all of our communities and social relations. It's most visible through Trumpism and the militia, but it's not limited to them alone.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by the co-author with Joseph Lowndes of Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity, which is published by the University of Minnesota Press. My guest is Daniel Martinez-Hosang. He's associate professor of ethnicity, race, and migration and of American studies at Yale University. His other books include Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California. So you mentioned a bit earlier in the program the 2016 militia occupation of the Mallard National Wildlife Refuge in eastern Oregon. Can you remind our listeners of what took place there and why you and your co-author choose to contrast it to insurgencies in Black communities like in Ferguson, Missouri, where Black Lives Matter began, and Flint, Michigan? Seemingly very different examples of upheaval.
Yeah, and we are certainly not equating them in any sense that they aspire to the same political vision or come from the same sources, but we're trying to put them into some kind of a relationship. So the quick background is Anman Bundy, who's typically identified as a rancher. His father, Clive N. Bundy, had standoffs with the federal government, the Bureau of Land Management, at his ranch in Nevada, had led a group of people in eastern Oregon in late 2015 that ultimately led to a takeover of this small wildlife refuge in eastern Oregon. And the immediate impetus for the takeover actually had to do with a federal mandatory minimum sentence that had been applied to a set of ranchers who had lit some fires on their property and who were long antagonistic towards the Bureau of Land Management, Department of Interior there. The point we made in laying out this history was that there had long been work in places like Oregon, led multiracial work, led by Black communities who had borne the brunt of policies like mandatory minimum sentences and who had critiqued a reliance on incarceration. Similarly, many of the conditions that the occupiers used then to legitimate what they were doing had to do with feelings of disenfranchisement in rural Oregon, the sense that Portland and the urban areas and economic elites had disregarded their lives, their conditions. And there was truth to that as well. There's many places at that time in southern Oregon and eastern Oregon where public libraries were closing, where there were almost there was places where 911 service was no longer available around the clock in public safety budgets to protect things like enforced domestic violence protection orders had arose. So they were, in that sense, speaking to actual conditions of disorder and abandonment. Unemployment levels and underemployment levels in many of those communities had risen into the kind of 20 to 30% areas. But rather than thinking about and connecting with those forces who had long identified those structural conditions, Black communities, absolutely indigenous communities and nations in that area who had long had a criticism of the federal government's use of land, rather than aligning with those groups, as we could imagine, they instead turned to a kind of longstanding settler notion, very much steeped in violence and autonomy, that insisted that it was only through these kind of violent confrontations and takeovers that they could kind of enact those, that anger, and reclaim their rightful status. So what we're trying to do is take seriously that there are powerful conditions that are fueling these forms of rebellion, but the lesson is they continually get channeled into these anti-statist and often racist projects, rather than what they could imagine doing, thinking about how they could align themselves with those groups that have understood these dynamics for a much.
Well, thinking through that, the tricky idea of how to come at these somewhat shared conditions in a different way, you write that in the past, social movements of the mid-20th century focused on sort of institutional inclusion, an inclusion into a growing pie, you know, that people of color had been shut out of things like, for example, public sector jobs or access to universities, and that people fought to include people into those institutions that were growing. But as you have said, in the last 4 decades, there's been a real evisceration of the welfare state and of many public institutions as well. So are there opportunities that you can see that are being somehow overlooked here in trying to make common cause with people who find themselves in precarious positions at a time where the pie is shrinking rather than growing?
Yeah, I mean, this really stems to the kind of height of the civil rights and Black freedom organizing in the late 1960s and early 1970s, especially as it came together around the Poor People's Movement that Dr. King had proposed before his assassination in 1968. There was some vision that the prevailing structures in US society, the market, employment, what the government does, all had to be changed, that the vision was never simply about accessing them, getting a proverbial seat at the table. They were incapable of meeting people's basic needs, and they had to be reimagined. The question of how they would be reimagined, always needed to be worked out and detailed in different ways. But it was a very clear sense that it wasn't simply about access. Part of the compromise and the response of the state, local, federal governments, owners of capital, was in fact a certain kind of incorporation. And I think for many years across the 70s, 80s, especially in a place like California, you could see the terms of that: increased access to the University of California and higher education, seats in state and local government, some access to jobs in the industries that kept California's economy going. Today, those spaces seem illusory, right? The notion that simply a degree from either the UC or the CSU is likely to cost a student far more than it did even 20 years ago. One's employment prospects are dim. There's no guarantee that it'll provide housing, food, etc. So the notion that the sense of dislocation and precarity and insecurity people feel can simply be satisfied by a return to those institutions, education, the market, government, et cetera, really seems diminished for many people. And so that's partly why we end the book by returning to those visions of anti-racist organizing and multiracial organizing is transformative, not simply about trying to work with a very pale vision of equity, like we want an equal right to be subject to debt or to be imprisoned or to be arrested, but that are much more rooted in transformation of all these institutions. And this is very much the vision that Dr. King has in 1968, when he can imagine that Black communities in the South and in the North, Mexican-American barrios in Denver and LA, could provide the leadership even for rural whites in coming and demanding a kind of new economic order. And we think absent that, absent those kinds of mobilizations and frameworks, the appeal of a certain kind of patriarchal nativist militia impulse to declare yourself disgusted and to rebel is going to have tremendous strength and appeal to many different people if we don't provide other alternatives.
Do you think, as part of that project of sort of reimagining a transformative project, do you think that part of it might need a rethinking about demands on the state? Because it is commonly seen amongst progressives that the anti-state response reflex that seems to run through a lot of the far right is a problem. And, in some sense, false consciousness that the state actually is subsidizing these people in various ways and that they benefit from the state and they don't really get that the state is their friend. But on the other hand, just as you're indicating, many communities of color have very different relationships with the state. How do you think that question of the state should play into rethinking a politics that perhaps could pull people together for a very different vision of the future?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right in that ambivalences about the state and the role of the government in people's lives run across the political spectrum. They're complicated and they're grounded in many real experiences. And the experience of the pandemic in the last 10 months has demonstrated and dramatized all of those. So on the one hand, absent stimulus payments from the federal government, a whole range of supports to the finance industry, to particular sectors, towards, you know, making meals available and educational resources to local communities and schools, we would be in an absolutely dystopian situation. So the importance of collective action has really been demonstrated by all of those. On the other hand, I mean, think about how incredibly uneven the response has been in terms of public health, in terms of directions, in terms of what the state has done to be able to keep people safe, manage the spread of the virus, how varied it's been, how it varies by state to state, jurisdiction to jurisdiction. So I'm saying people are seeing in real time all of these contradictions unfold, that on the one hand, it's you both need it, and it's the source of all of our kind of possibilities. And on the other hand, you're feel stymied and complexed and challenged by it. So those are precisely the dynamics that I think a new wave of, you know, people like Reverend William Barber calling for a kind of a third reconstruction, a public reconstruction, a reimagination of the public good and public goods, that's not simply a return to the New Deal and all of the ways that it missed and reinforced inequalities, but an absolutely new vision that takes people's experiences with state violence and the abandonment of the government seriously, but yeah, can collectively imagine those in new ways. And certainly one of the things I worry about the response to the events in the last week is that it hasn't had that effect. It suggested that our only way to safeguard ourselves from these kind of fascist elements is to consent and align ourselves with all of the kind of existing and very uneven forms of governance that exist now, the so-called return to normal. And I think that's why an alternative is so desperately needed to redirect this energy.
Ethnic studies scholar Daniel Martinez-Hosang is my guest. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We're talking about his book, co-authored with Joseph Lowndes, of Producers, Parasites, Patriots, Race, and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity. So then thinking about how to struggle for a different vision beyond the inequalities and divisions of the status quo, the insufficiencies of the status quo, what would you say are the implications for your ideas about the shifting terrain of race? What you're arguing is not that it makes it the case that white people are now facing the same sort of discrimination or oppression that people of color have, but that the ways that precarity operates for white people has changed, that white people have become, especially working class people, much more precarious, and that these sort of racial categories have been applied to them. So if that's the case, does that have any implications for forging alliances between white working class people and people of color, despite, as you noted, the context of the shrinking pie? And if so, how does one go beyond what you term the blandness of white allyship, the idea of white people being allies for people of color, but rather something that's linked in solidarity and mutual aid?
Yeah, I think, you know, you're seeing this most robustly in different rural communities. There's a wonderful group in Oregon, the Rural Organizing Project, but this is happening all over the South as well, where rather than presuming that, let's say, rural, largely white, although sometimes white and multiracial areas, simply automatically align with the reactionary politics expressed by the militia, that in fact, those same residents who, again, are increasingly experiencing the sense that there's no one looking out for their interests, even some sense that the whiteness that they've long identified with no longer safeguards themselves from sickness and misery and early death, that they would see in these new multiracial formations, immigrant rights movements, the movement for Black Lives, possibility, not just because it's helping someone else Although their importance about raising the long-standing needs and issues of Black communities, Indigenous communities, but because that vision that they're articulating actually has payoff and benefits for a wide, wide range of people. So we argue, if you look at the policy platform for something like the Movement for Black Lives, that argues about taking money away from not just policing but also the military, supporting labor unions, building broad policy around workers' rights, has much more payoff for the many folks in Eastern Oregon than anything that the militias would offer. And that happens through, I think, that kind of very brick and mortar day-to-day organizing that's happening in rural communities. I think it's happening in many teachers' organizations where teachers are realizing in places like Chicago and Los Angeles that the fight for their students around immigration, against racial profiling, for healthcare services is instrumental to their fight as public sector workers. So we're seeing these not as kind of tactical alliances that are, I'll give you this if you give me that, but really, the way people's fate are linked and that you have to do the organizing work to make that visible for people.
You argue that elites are committed to symbolic forms of multiculturalism and racial pluralism while perpetuating vast racial and class inequalities. And I wanted to ask you that, given that, whether you think there's a danger in anti-racist activists directing much of their energies to symbolic actions, say, renaming buildings, rather than struggling for structural changes around inequality, which is, of course, undoubtedly a much harder task.
Yeah, I don't think of this as an either-or. The struggle over the monuments this summer and building renamings are often about challenging long-standing symbols and narratives that legitimate people's dispossession and, subordination and suffering. So it makes sense that those are very often the kind of point of entry for people's energies. But I think the real danger is to not recognize that all of these institutions, look, every investment bank, Wall Street firm now has an Office of Diversity and Inclusion, has committed itself to, and is constantly absorbing language from social movements, even ending the racial wealth gap. So that's pervasive. And so if we don't also have an analysis of the way that the everyday structures of the market and governance have this effect of reinforcing and widening inequality and domination, we're only going to be able to be incorporated by these appeals rather than figuring out how to contest them. So the point is that this language around multiculturalism and diversity in and of itself is inadequate to offer a real opposition. It emerged from particular places and times, and movements make use of it, but simply calling for greater diversity or incorporation or inclusion without asking about inclusion into what is certainly not.
Well, how does that happen? Because obviously that appropriation of the language of struggle is a long part of how elites fend off forms of dissent, and particularly under capitalism. Capitalism seems particularly effective in appropriation and even turning things into new avenues for commodification, for selling things and having new buyers. But how then do you think one can resist that push? Are these battles to be fought on the level of sort of rhetoric or more strategic questions about how one does one's politics and focus one's energies?
Yeah, I think it's very much the latter. And again, we can turn to active organizing examples. So the Chicago Teachers Union, when they fought around their contracts in both the early 2010s and 2 years ago, really spent a lot of time trying to make the connection between the forms of tax breaks in the through land use and investment plans that the city was engaging in, and what they kind of called like an austerity by design. So the kind of enforced austerity budgets that were imposed on the city. But to do that, they actually thought about where they're going to mobilize their rallies with the symbols and the sites that they're going to connect people to try to raise their consciousness around that. Teachers in California have done the same thing around charter school fundings and the role of financial elites in supporting those. So I think those examples of where social mode organizations are trying to take these very complex and abstract forces about financialization, the kind of hoarding of wealth in particular sectors to make them real in people's lives is precisely the challenge in front of us. And you know, with state legislatures are now reconvening all across the country, all facing dramatic deficits. There's no vision of public goods and public services that doesn't require a real look at revenues and how wealth is conceptualized. And that can't just be done through email campaigns. It actually has to be done through the day-to-day organizing led by groups of workers.
I'm afraid we're entirely out of time. Daniel Martinez Hosang, thank you so much for your time today.
Such a pleasure talking to you, and really appreciate the invitation.
Daniel Martinez Hosang is Associate Professor of Ethnicity, Race, and Migration and of American Studies at Yale University. He's the co-author with Joseph Lowndes of Producers, Parasites, and Patriots, Race, and the New Right-Wing Politics of Precarity, which was published by the University of Minnesota Press. You can find a link to that book, as well as an article that they co-authored at our website, againstthegrain.org. Daniel Hosang is the author of Racial Propositions, Ballot Initiatives, and the Making of Postwar California, and the forthcoming book, out in the fall, A Wider Type of Freedom. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.